Welcome to Healing for the Four Folds of Life on TalkZone.com. Here's your host, natural healing practitioner, Terry L. Page.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Healing for the Four Folds of Life. On today's show, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. Normally, we talk about different types of healing or different aspects of natural healing that you may not be aware of. Today, I'm going to honor some group of people that are almost always forgotten, and that is the caregiver. So this show is caring for the caregiver. Now, a caregiver can be anyone from a parent to a spouse or even a friend who is caring for another person who cannot care for themselves, whether from defects or injury or illness. But today we're going to focus on the loved one who has had to step up and take the place of caregiver for someone that they have very, you know, close to them. Imagine suddenly that you find yourself the caregiver for a loved one with a terminal illness. You trudge through day by day, not knowing if you're making the right decisions, choosing the right doctors, following the right advice, all while you're watching the person that you love slowly die. Being a caregiver is one of the toughest acts of love to live. Often the caregiver is overlooked by all, including themselves, as they make this journey with their loved ones. It takes an overwhelming toll on one's emotions, time, energy, and health. There are times you fear you won't survive, but you somehow pull it together just enough for one more day to be strong for the ones you love and care for. Healing from such an experience can be a lonely, frightening path to walk. No one wants to think about this possibility, yet many people all over the world find that they are suddenly forced to. And let's face it, with the rising costs of healthcare, many more will find themselves in a caregiver role at some point in their adult lives than ever before. In this eventuality, wouldn't it be a blessing to have someone take you by the hand and share with you just a clue about not only what to do and not to do, but how to heal the heartbreak that inevitably comes with it? My guest today is Mr. J. Dietrich Stroh. He is the author of 3 Months, A Caregiving Journey from Heartbreak to Healing. And in this wonderful book, he does just this. And I'm really grateful that he is here today to give us more insight on his experience as both caregiver and to talk about this wonderful book. Welcome, Mr. Stroh, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's all the way here in California. Wonderful weather here.
Oh, I bet it's beautiful there. It's actually kind of warm today, and looks like it's going to be a little bit stormy here. So, Hopefully you've got the sun.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now you wrote this book after your experience with your wife, Margaret. What inspired you to write 3 Months, a Caregiving Journey from Heartbreak to Healing?
Well, I actually didn't start out writing a book. What I was doing in the evenings to kind of get through the evening before trying to finally go to sleep, I would write notes about what went on and just write stuff down, all kinds of stuff, all the way from how the cats reacted to her illness to laughter to pain to whatever, and just little episodes. And about 3 or 4 months into that process, I said to myself, I wonder if I put this into a book form, if people could benefit from what it's like to go through this. And eventually everybody does, one way or another. And so that's sort of how the book got started, and we decided to actually, not only what I went through, but also every other alternate chapter is about healing itself, caregiving, and what to do, what to look for, and all the rest. And you're right. You know, this is one of those things that nobody is trained for, nobody is expecting, and there you are. You're right in the middle of it. And so every day, every minute, every hour is a new challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've had a little bit of experience with that, not as up close and personal as you have, but I remember one thing that you said early on in your book was the hardest part about having your world come apart at the seams is that the rest of the world doesn't miss a beat.
No.
That statement
exactly
so perfectly voiced the way I felt when my mother was dying.
Yeah, that's very true, and that's exactly it. But what you do find, the rest of the world or your immediate world, whatever it is, family to friends to whatever, they come forward and help. They reach out to you. They, very simple ways, just come up to you and give you a hug. You know, that type of thing.
And sometimes that's what you really need.
Well, yeah, no question about it. And after Margaret died, I became one heck of a hugger, I'll tell you that much. I hugged everybody, even people on the street, so to speak. I still am, but I always have been. But that's one of the things you learn in this whole business is that it's okay to hug. I don't care if it's a man, woman, or a kangaroo. You hug people. It's a way of communicating grief, so to speak.
That is definitely a lesson I learned early on. When I was in high school, I had a good friend die, and she died suddenly. Mm-hmm. And we realized how precious each moment was, and we didn't know when we said goodbye if we were going to see them again. So we always made sure to say, I love you, and hug each other.
Exactly. We have I have an engineering firm, and as most engineers, they don't talk much, but they don't show much emotion. But I am one, so I can say that.
Yeah.
But
I'm married to one, so I totally understand.
Okay, there you go. Well, we have a lady engineer. She's really good, and she very rarely talks. She walked in my office and kind of motioned me to stand up. She comes over me, big hug, and then walked out. Never said a word. But that was enough. Yeah. That was enough right there.
She conveyed everything she needed to say.
Right on. No question.
So what is the first thing that you would tell somebody who suddenly finds themselves in a caregiver role for a loved one with a life-threatening illness?
Take one step at a time. Don't panic. Don't throw up your hands. Say, what do I do? What do I do? Listen to the experts. Do what you can. And I think one of the things is that with the loved one is the fact that they are still your loved one. And number one, number two, if there was humor in the relationship, if there was a great relationship of some sort, keep that going, even though the individual may not understand what's happening. As an example, Margaret and I had a tremendous amount of humor between the two of us, and we could laugh just kind of out loud. And a number of things occurred during that whole process of 3 months from the time she was diagnosed to the time she died, that there was a very humorous times, and we laughed and giggled, and nothing wrong with that. Do stuff that with the individual that you have done before. Don't change the habits other than the individual is changing on you rapidly, and just live with it. Just take it for whatever it's worth, and so eventually they're gone, but don't try to do more than you can do. And there are a lot of help out there. A lot of people will come forward to help you to get through that, if it's family or friends or whatever.
Okay, yeah, you mentioned that in your book, that people will always pretty much give you the same, you know, I'm sorry, you know, if there's anything I can do, let me know. And some people do mean this. Is there anything that you found particularly helpful to ask them to do that to actually let them help you?
Well, it's interesting how that comes about. It depends on the individual, obviously, but it's when Margaret was diagnosed and she was still in the hospital, we're bringing her home. A very good friend of ours said, "Call me anytime. Call me anytime, and I'll sit with Margaret and be with her if you want to go out and do whatever you're going to do." So about a month later, I did call her. I had to get out and do some stuff, and I called her. She said, "Well, I don't have time to go over there." So you never know how people react to this type of thing. And you take it for what it's worth. Don't get uptight. Don't get upset with it. You know, and people react to this type of thing very differently. So don't expect the norm. There is no norm. Mm-hmm. It just isn't. People will come to visit Margaret, or did come to visit Margaret, and just talk about all kinds of stuff, but never ask her how she's feeling or they do talk about how mm-hmm. she's feeling. And Margaret was one of those individuals that had a very social outlook on life. And if someone came in and talked, she would be constantly smiling. And everybody thought, oh, well, she's okay. Nothing wrong with her. Yet she didn't understand what was going on.
A lot of people find it very hard, especially if they've not had any experience with losing a loved one. They find it very hard to even consider that they're going to lose this person.
That's right.
So they ignore the whole topic. And I remember my mother, for one thing, all our lives, my brother and I were drilled into our heads. When I die, you do this, 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 and this. And we're like, oh, Mom, stop talking about that, because we didn't want to think about losing her.
Right.
But when the time came, we were like robots, and it was so nice to know her wishes and not have to think about it.
Well, but you know, that's real, what you just said. And then mm-hmm. Margaret and I had this, all the things that needed to be done after a person, individual, whoever died, me or her, but we have our graves, we have all this stuff, and knew what we were going to do. And you do become a robot when that all occurs. I have had the opportunity, sadly, but I've lost both parents and two sisters, and now Margaret. And so I was somewhat experienced of what to do and how to handle it, what have you. Just a simple thing of calling the mortuary and come to pick her up. And that was an interesting thing, too. When they did come, a good friend of mine who runs the place, he brought all his stuff in, the body bag and everything else. And Margaret's favorite color was green. And the body bag was green. So you get little things like that occur, and you start wondering, well, there's got to be something more out there that's watching over us.
Yeah. It's little things like that also help you heal, because you say, oh, well, she would like that.
That's exactly happened. And when we did the memorial, it hadn't rained here in California for, I don't know, 2 months or whatever it was. We did the memorial. It rained that day. She loved the rain.
Well, see, a lot of people would look at it that as a negative, but here you saw it as a positive thing.
Exactly, exactly. And the other thing that happened, which really blew me away, we have a whole bed of daffodils that were blooming. And 3 days before she died, I pushed her out in the wheelchair, and we were looking at the daffodils, and we were talking about them, how beautiful they were, and blah, blah, blah. And the day she died, they were dead. They died. So things like that make you wonder, you know, somebody's watching. Somehow or another, something's out there saying, hey, we're here to help.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely am a firm believer that they do hang around for a little while to make sure we're okay.
Yeah.
And I think they watch.
Yep.
Because I know my mother. She stayed around for about 2 months. I could feel her. You could smell her perfume. Just little things about that particular perfume they didn't really make. You had to really hunt for it, and you would smell it out of nowhere. Just little things, like her favorite flower was a gardenia that would she would show up.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's just their way of saying it's okay.
That's exactly it. And I think one of the pieces of it all, when you finally realize that what's going on and what you have to do and what ultimately occurs, You realize that this isn't anything new. But it's new for you, but it's not new for the world. People go through this on a minute by minute basis. And one of the things I look back on this whole thing is a process, if you will. And it's a process of leaving us, that's all.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is a natural thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come right back and continue our wonderful conversation about your book.
Welcome back to Healing for the Four Folds of Life. Here's Terry Page.
Welcome back, everybody. And joining me today is Dietrich Stroh to speak about his wonderful, wonderful book that he wrote, not only as a resource for people, but to share an experience that is very frightening for a lot of people. The title of his book is 3 months, caregiving journey from heartbreak to healing. And I highly recommend it because at some point in your life, you're probably going to need this information. Now, Dee, you had said in the book that there's a staggering amount of people that find themselves caregivers.
That's right. That's right. It's I don't know. I've forgotten the statistic now, but it really is.
Like 65 million.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. In a lot of ways, it can be very small ways of being a caregiver, but yet you're still there. You're responsible mm-hmm. for whatever is going to occur and take care of the individual that's passing away.
And I think it makes, even if it's a small way, it gives them the knowledge that somebody cares and somebody is there for them.
Yes.
So it's no significant role, no matter how big of a part you play.
Well, that's another thing you find out is the individual. Sometimes you wonder, like Margaret, sometimes I wonder if she understood what was going on, even watching movies. But she was listening. And all of a sudden you'd say something to her and she'd smile. And you knew darn well that she knew what you were saying. But mm-hmm. And again, being natural about it. I know that's kind of screwy the way to say that, but be natural with it. If you had a good relationship with the individual, keep that relationship going.
And enjoy
that relationship. Nothing wrong with that.
Okay, now, as a caregiver, what aspects of your role as caregiver most significantly affected your life or work, and how did you manage them?
Oh, man. But one of the things I found myself, I couldn't sleep at night. I started drinking too much, and I cut that out. And I went to the doctor, and he finally gave me some sleeping pill stuff, which worked. But you're constantly with something on your shoulder. You're constantly thinking about what's going on. How do I do this? How do I do that? Am I doing it right? God, mm-hmm. I hope she doesn't get a huge, heavy-duty fever, which I have to take her to emergency. And, you know, all these little things that you're doing. That's part of it. And just the simple fact that you have to help them go to the bathroom and all the rest of this stuff, you become one, so to speak. And mm-hmm. you emotionally, it's ups and downs like a yo-yo. But, you know, somehow or another you weather it. And I think I fell apart after she died. I just completely fell apart. And so it's not easy, but at the same time, be as natural as you can be. Be as natural as you can be with the individual. Mm. And there are going to be times when the individual doesn't listen, won't do this or won't do that.
Margaret, you're not everybody's a good patient.
No, well, that's right. And Margaret didn't like to eat much. So we just, what we did, she loved chocolate ice cream. So we fed her chocolate ice cream.
People say,
what the hell are you doing that for? She goes, that's not good. What difference does it make?
Exactly.
Passing away, you know?
What's it going to do, kill her? I mean, yeah. Let her have what she wants.
Right on. I remember my sister's talking about my dad. He was on his way out, too. And then they said, oh, he's got to quit doing this. He's got to quit doing that. I said, let him do it. You're not going to be here very long. Who cares?
Yeah, what harm could it do at this point? Let him be happy.
Right on. That's it.
I totally agree. To me, I want her happy for as long as she possibly can be. And if I can do anything to make that, it's like my father, though, you mentioned the ice cream. That's pretty much what he eats is ice cream. But at 85 years old, it's not going to hurt him.
No.
Let him have it.
What it extends is not eating it. It extends his life a half a day. I mean, what does it mean?
Exactly.
Sounds coarse, but it's real.
That all falls back into keeping balance. And I know one thing you said early on was that it was almost a constant struggle to find balance.
That's right.
Both emotionally, mentally, for your sake, as much as Margaret's. Was there anything that stood out that actually worked that helped you maintain balance or at least look like you did?
Talking to people, talking about what's going on. And most people, even though they may not want to listen to it, but they will listen and be compassionate with you, but talk it out. Talk with people. And don't hold it in. that's not going to do you a darn bit of good to hold it. None. And it just gets worse.
That's so true.
I would explain almost hourly what was going on with Margaret on a daily basis with people, especially my partners and my work and my friends and all the rest. And that's the other thing. Keep busy in some fashion, whatever it is. Just don't sit around and watch television. That doesn't do anybody good, but keep busy doing something.
Yeah, and if you're sitting and dwelling on the inevitable, then that's not going to do either of you any good.
No, exactly. Exactly. Very true.
You talked about acknowledging your own emotions. I know a lot of people, especially with men, it's very, very difficult for men to express emotions because certain generations were programmed from boyhood not to cry.
That's right. That's right. And I was lucky to grow up in a family that it was okay, so to speak. And I had a very loving father and mother, and my father, I was with my father constantly. He was a very compassionate man, and I guess I picked up a lot of that from him. But that's okay to cry. It's okay to let in front of strangers. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. And the problem with us men, yeah, you're right. We're somehow or another, we're in a mold. It's, oh, you can't do this. You shouldn't do that. Be a man, so to speak. Well, what the hell, being a man, you still have that emotion.
Yeah.
And you know, not good to suppress it.
No, it isn't. Otherwise, you become a ticking time bomb of emotion.
That's right. That's right.
Eventually, you're going to explode. So that's true of just about any emotional stress or any stress, period. You need to get it out.
Yeah, exactly. No question about it. And you know, I had my partner, he lost his son to a brain tumor. His kid was 30 years old. And so he was very, very compassionate with me. And then we hugged a lot. And just because we both had gone through it. So that's the other piece. It's okay to, the other thing is, it's okay to laugh. It's okay to have a joke. It's okay to feel good in some way. Because if you don't, again, you need to go through all those emotions. And there's nothing wrong with it. People say, oh, you shouldn't laugh. You shouldn't. There's no humor in it. Well, Margaret and I had the humor. 3 days before she died, I have to tell you this story. 3 days before she died, I had a lady here helping a little bit, and she was in bed, completely nude, laying there, and the lady was kind of sponge bathing her off and kind of cleaning her up a little bit, so to speak. And I walked in the bedroom, I was standing at the end of the bed, and Margaret lifts her head up and says simply to me, "What are you doing in here, you dirty old man?" I said, "Being a dirty old man," and we all laughed. And I know maybe that sounds silly, but it relieves the tension, so to speak.
No, I guess you have to find the humor where you can. I mean, it's like, how do you find humor in the middle of a swirling tempest? But it seems like you've managed to do it pretty well.
Well, I think we did, and there were times when there's stuff that went on that we kid each other, and for instance, I push her out. We live kind of on somewhat of a hill, and then I push her out in a wheelchair, and their driveway drops down to the main road, and I at the top of the thing, I think I'll let you go, and you can ride down there by yourself. No, don't do that. Don't do that. I won't do that. You know I wouldn't do that. And I start to give her. Anyway, she laughs, and we laugh, and you know, but the simple stuff, simple thing. Margaret loved movies, and I have a whole library here of old movies, and I don't know if she understood half the time what was going on, but she sat there smiling, watching it.
Well, the thing is it makes you feel better to at least be doing something for her.
Yes.
When my mother was in a coma, we didn't know whether she could hear us or not, but her, my brother, and I had written a poem book, and we took it in, and we read every single poem to her.
Oh, that's neat.
And that's when she started going into some sort of seizure, and they ushered us out, and the next day they pronounced her brain dead. I think she waited until we read the very last poem. And then she, I think she stayed there to hear.
Right, right. That could very well be. Yeah.
One thing you said in the book that I felt was a great reminder, and it's a good reminder for any time, not just when you're trying to maintain balance. But you said modern medicine is full of tough days, and if you can help lighten somebody's day, they're likely to remember you. And that's so true. I remember when my girlfriend had left the hospital and her mother was on her deathbed, and she must have had this real sad face, and there was a homeless lady on the side of the road, and she looked over and saw her, and she pointed her fingers up to the corners of her mouth and made a smile and waved at her, and she said that made her smile. That was the first time that she laughed in months, and it made all the difference.
Yep. See, the simple thing like that, exactly how you relieve tension, how you can accept what's going on, you can accept the pressure of taking care of the individual, and no matter how it manifests itself.
Yeah.
You just never know where it's going to come from. Never know.
Well, you talked about many of a waiting nightmare in your book when you were waiting for this or waiting for that or in this waiting room.
Okay.
And, you know, just a little kindness to somebody sitting next to you, they're either a caregiver or in there fighting for their life themselves.
Yeah.
So they're probably not having the greatest of days either.
I think I read every employment circular that was on the wall in a hospital. You know, you find things to do to occupy your mind, and that's one of the things I suggest is take your laptop, take a book, have something to read or whatever while you're waiting, because there's a constant waiting thing that goes on, and you can't just sit there and look out the window. You've got to somehow not occupy your mind and waiting for the doctor, waiting for the nurse, waiting for something, you know, someone come along, technician of some sort. But as I say, it was a funny part. You get to know every darn circular that's on these bulletin boards in the hospital, and you have to do something.
Yeah, this is true. You know, we're going to take another brief break, and we will return in just a moment.
And now, more Healing for the Four Folds of Life on TalkZone.com. Here's Terry Page.
Welcome back, everybody. Joining me today is Zetrick Stroh, author of 3 Months, A Caregiving Journey from Heartbreak to Healing. Well, Deet, looking back at your experience, is there any one pivotal moment that you would like to share with us?
Well, there was a number of them, but I think the most pivotal one was we didn't know what was wrong with Margaret, and then they did the CAT scan and determined that she had large tumors on her pancreas and then throughout the whole abdominal cavity, and that obviously was a pivotal moment. We knew fully well that anything to do with the pancreas and that the tumor and it was didn't look good, and we didn't know exactly what we had and how long she had or anything like that at that point, but that was a heavy duty moment, and we both cried and hugged. In fact, the little nurse that was there, she was so cute, she hugged with us.
No,
so we standing there hugging, when Margaret was actually on the gurney. And anyway, that was a heavy duty moment, and then they put her in the hospital for that night because they were going to drain her abdominal cavity. It filled with fluid because of the cancer. And anyway, I mean, long story short, we stayed overnight. They set up a little cot for me to stay there too, and I was cold, so I put Margaret's robe on. And about the middle of the night, I woke up or got up, and I thought, oh geez, I better take this robe off. I think that this is why I'm be Margaret. They're gonna come in and try to minister some medicine to me. So I got up and walked out, and then I cried for quite a while. But you know, that was the heavy duty moment. And once we got through the whole diagnosis, through the talking with the cancer doctor, and that she had maybe 9 months to a year to live, and other things started happening. The cancer had spread to her bowel, and she couldn't eliminate, so they did a bypass surgery, and then as she had been in the hospital, she got home and all of a sudden had a staph infection, had to go back to hospital.
Oh.
So there were a number of times when there were, let's say, pivotal moments, but I think the most memorable one was when last time she was in the hospital, a month before she died, we were in the hospital and the doctor was there and what have you. And so the question was me to do more chemo or stay in the hospital and all this stuff. And I asked Margaret, I said, what do you want to do? Do you want to go home or do you want to continue with the chemo? And she says, what do you want to do? What do you think we should do? And I says, I think we ought to go home. She says, that's right. Let's go home. And that was the best month of the 3 months.
Yeah.
And she just quietly passed away.
Well, at some point, there was a point where you began to accept that a full recovery was not impossible, but also not likely, when all the reality actually hit you. And what point would you say was where it really felt real?
That last month. And, you know, one of the things you have, at least I do, and I'm sure this is true with a lot of other people, is hope. It's a simple word, hope. And you just can't believe this is happening. And somehow or another, subconsciously, you just think, oh, okay, it'll turn. Something will happen. Something will change. Even though, as from a practical standpoint or from a logic standpoint, you know darn well the person's dying. And you can see it. But you just still think, and then I remember after she passed away and they took her away, and my partners showed up over here, and we sat outside and sat between them and was crying. And I said, what do I do now? What am I going to do now?
Mm-hmm.
And I was completely lost. So the word hope was gone because of the fact she's not around.
People don't realize how desperately hope is something that they cling to.
Yeah.
Just about every aspect of life until there is none.
Right. That's it.
How did this realization have an effect on you physically as well as mentally and emotionally?
Well, as I say, physically, I lost a lot of weight. Although I wasn't eating properly. Stuff like that, not sleeping well. And emotionally, somehow or another, that wasn't a heavy-duty thing. It was, but it wasn't, so to speak, until the reality of the fact that you wasn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you don't. Again, I'm going to say this: everybody's different. How you're affected by it, and I think if you had a good relationship with the individual, it's a lot easier. If the relationship isn't a good one, then that's another whole ball game. And it becomes kind of a functional thing to take care of them. But you're constantly looking at them. And I remember saying a couple of weeks before Margaret died that she was so debilitated. She had lost so much weight. She was with skin and bones. And she literally was passing in front of my eyes. And I said to my partner, I said, geez, I don't know if I can handle that anymore. I wish she'd go, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. You wish that it would end just for the both of your sakes, so the suffering would stop.
Right.
Now, Deet, in this wonderful book that you have compiled and created, you not only give a wealth of information of lists from doctor and medical staff questions, but you give resources to aid new caregivers. There's so much with your own personal experiences in there. What is your hope that other caregivers will get from this book?
That you're not alone.
Yeah.
You're not alone. And that is a given. That is something you've got to accept, the fact that your other people have gone through it, and reach out to them. It's okay. You're not alone. It's always like the business of a young couple has their first baby. Well, it's the only baby in the world, right? There's never been a baby before. Well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And so talk about it.
Yeah.
Talk it out. Find someone that's willing to listen to you. Talk. Don't bore them to death. But
well, I guess now they didn't so much in years past, but now there's more like support groups. I notice even driving by the funeral home a couple of streets over, they have a support group that meets once a week for people to come and share their emotions and how they're feeling. So even if, you know, sometimes a stranger's the best person to talk to.
Yeah, no, then that's good. That's good. There are support groups for everything now. almost everything.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is.
And chat rooms, even. You don't even have to go in person.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any
pitfalls that is common for caregivers to fall into that you would kind of like to warn people about or make aware of?
I think one of the main ones would be that you think you know everything. It may not. I mean medically. If, in fact, there's medical issues, and there obviously would be something going on that's, you know, the cancer or whatever they're dying from, and to be able to follow those, what you have to do. What I found what was interesting is that I would ask questions. What am I going to see if she goes into it, has a heavy-duty fever? What if she is 106? What am I going to see? What's it going to look like? They can't tell you. They don't know. They don't know themselves, whoever it may be, the technician, the nurse, the doctor, whatever. Well, you just better get it to emergency. Well, that's true. There's no question about it.
But how do you know when that point is? That's interesting that they could not tell you that.
Well, I mean, she's not going to feel well. Well, how do I know how she's feeling?
She's not feeling well now, so.
That's right. And that's not a negative about the world around us, but again, everybody reacts differently. I was talking to the doctor the other day about something that about myself, and I says, "What's the real norm?" She says, "Well, there's two norms: the pathological one, which is the medical one, and then there's how you feel." I said, "Whoa, which one do you go by?" I was talking to her; she's a doctor. She says, "Well, the pathological one." I says, "What about how I feel?" I says, "I feel fine." She says, "Well, then you're okay." Well, then what's the answer? I mean, it's not a negative. It's just that is one of the things I think. Don't panic about what you know or don't know. And ask. Don't be afraid to ask. Oh, that's the other piece of it. When you're talking to the doctor and all the stuff is whirling around in your head, take as many notes as you can and bring a friend along that can also listen and be another set of ears.
I think I'd bring a digital voice recorder.
Yeah, there you go.
Just so I wouldn't forget anything, because I know my mind would be spinning.
Yep, that's about it. Right.
Now, you said that this took a toll on you, on your health, not to mention your mind and your emotions. Was there anything other than talking that you found made even a difference to helping you keep your health or your mind from declining?
I don't know if there's just one thing. First of all, as far as your health is concerned, you've got to realize it and take stock of yourself and say, wait a minute, there's something, I've got to do something about this, and do it. Don't let it, because it's not going to do anybody a good if you get sick. And I think the other piece of it is if you have, again, as I said earlier, if you have somebody that's close to you that you can talk with and work through it is critical. I have three daughters, and two of them live here in town. And so I had that relationship there. Very simple.
That was wonderful.
Yeah.
Calling on family.
Yeah.
I know you also said in there that you started taking up a little bit of the gardening only because your wife had loved it so much. It made you feel a little closer to her, I guess.
Well, that's one piece. And we always were both good gardeners, and I still am, and I grow a lot of vegetables and what have you. So that it was during the winter time, and I had to prune the fruit trees and prune some of the trees around here. So I went out and pruned trees, and just to get my mind on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And while she was sleeping or whatever was going on.
And did you find that some of the physical exercise alone helped you, especially with sleeping, I would think?
Oh, yes. Oh, no question about that. And both of us have always done a lot of physical stuff like that, so that we're in fairly decent shape. And so that was helpful. And just to merely keep your hands busy. You know, you can't just sit and watch television all day long. That doesn't do a darn bit of good.
No, that would, especially with some of the things that are on TV these days.
Oh, yeah.
Did you find it all? I know I have run across this with patients in the past. Did you find it all that when you were caring for Margaret, that when you accepted somebody else's help so that she could go do something for you, that you felt guilty or that you shouldn't be doing this, you should be helping? Or
No.
That's wonderful.
I never had that feeling. And 'cause the way I managed the business, the way I managed when I've been involved in supervisory positions and management positions most of my life, and I expect the individual that I worked for me is doing what they're supposed to be doing, and I don't get in the middle of their what they're doing. And I mean, I'll give a direction, I'll mentor them, but I won't, I expect that. Now, that can be a problem, because they may screw up, and the next thing you know, you're responsible for what they're doing, and you should have been watching them closer. But at the same time, I expect them to handle it. And I never felt guilty. If I had people here helping out, and for instance, giving her a shower, and we had that all set up where she had a chair in there, and would have so she could shower, and the lady would help her do that, and I didn't stand there and watch, and I'll do this, do that, do the next thing, and I expect things to happen. That's all.
Yeah, I could see how at some point it would be inevitable, where you would just have to, by sheer exhaustion, accept help. There are some people that get sort of the martyr idea in their head, and they don't want to. They think that they can do it all themselves, and I think that is a quick road to burnout.
No, that's not good. You've got to expect other folks. Again, as I say, we had hospice, and they brought nurses in every so often, and listening to them, talking with them, and asking questions, and you got to rely on other folks to be able to help you through this whole process. And as I say, medically, you may not understand what's needed. So you've got to rely on the medical profession to be able to get through.
So there's a certain level of trust that you're going to have to develop there.
Right on.
All right, we're going to take another quick break, and then we're going to finish up our show when we return.
Let's return to Terry Page for more healing for the fourfolds of life on TalkZone.com.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. And joining me is Cetric Stroh, author of 3 Months, A Caregiving Journey from Heartbreak to Healing. We've been discussing ways of caring for the caretaker along the journey of being a caregiver. In the 3 years that you have passed, that have passed since Margaret has died, you've learned to push forward, you've learned to recover, to live your life, to even love again. Can you tell us a little bit about your process?
Well, the reason I'm giggling is that it is a process. And about 9 or 10 months after Margaret passed away, I woke up one morning, got up out of bed, and I said, there's something wrong. I feel different. Why do I feel different? And I realized that the pain and the emptiness was gone, just like that. And
wow.
I have been, over the last three or four years, going to these water meetings here in California, where a whole group of contractors got together to talk about water stuff. And anyway, there was a lady that we used to sit next to each other, and we got to know each other. We were friends and what have you. And anyway, I was sitting there in one of these meetings after this feeling had gone away about a couple weeks later, and then I screwed up my courage and asked her out that she'd go to dinner with me. Well, that led to one thing after another, and now we're married. But it is a process. That's another thing I like to tell people. You do get better. There is a hope at the end of it, so to speak, that you don't lose the love for that person. You don't lose the memories, but the pain and the emptiness does go away.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I used to tell people. Is you never stop missing them or loving them, but it gets easier.
Oh, yeah.
It gets a little easier each day.
It does. And I think, you know, if one neat thing about my new wife, Donna, she understands perfectly about this book. She was, well, this thing got published while we were married. So and she actually pushes the book most of the time.
That is so wonderful that you are able to, you know, recover to the point where you allowed your heart to open again. Because so many people will close the door shut on their heart.
Yep.
And think that that's it. Their life is over.
Yeah. No. I know. It's but it is, again, I'm going to call it a process because it is. You finally, what you do is you just keep remembering the good memories. And you think about stuff that went on 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever it is, and or the trips you took or whatever it might be. And you just kind of revel in those things. Neat.
And you begin to smile instead of cry.
Oh, yeah. So I think my partner, who was our best man, said it simply at our wedding when he was, you know, saying whatever words he was going to say. He basically said, I knew that Deke had come a long way because he started smiling again.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
It does get better. I don't care how else you cut it. It does get better.
Yeah, healing your heart. Everyone must take this journey alone and finding healing for themselves.
Yes.
Reminds me of a line from one of my favorite Styx songs. This is, don't you know there's no place on this earth that you could run to escape the pain of a broken heart?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Everybody's trying. We all try. And eventually the sun does shine again.
It does. That's true. Very true.
So what did you find? Anything in particular that really helped you to reach those stages that you allowed yourself to do that maybe others won't think of?
Keep busy. Keep busy doing stuff. Whatever.
Keep living life.
Right on. That's it. And don't shrivel up on the couch and go away yourself. Get out, do stuff, get involved with what's going on or whatever it may be. And I was kind of semi-retired, and I was only working 3 days a week at the office, and I went full-time just to keep busy, just to keep things going. And did I find that I'm involved in a lot of boards of directors. I'm involved with all kinds of outside activities, so I still am. I enjoy it. I love it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. For you, on this wonderful experience, I mean, it's heartbreaking, but it's also a wonderful, enlightening experience that you've gone through. How have you found that it has changed your life's priorities?
Take one day at a time. You always have some goal out there in front of you. Laugh. I know that sounds silly and simplistic, but it's really true. You hug at people. I don't know. I'm more calm. Of course, I'm 78 years old, so I guess I ought to be calm by now. But it does change you. You know, again, as I said, I lost sisters and my parents and what have you. So you kind of, and I hate to put it this way, but you kind of get used to this thing, so to speak. So you've put each one of these deaths and each one of these people in a little box someplace in your mind, and you draw from that box every so often for called memories.
Well, Dee, we're coming to the end of the show. Is there any websites that you would like to share or some information on your book? I know there's some of these people would probably like to rush right out and get it.
yes, the website is www.3months, it's a plural month, book.com. So it's the title itself, 3months, book.com.
www. Okay, and it's, I'm sure, available in bookstores, or you can order it online.
We can order it, or there's another way of getting it, if all can't do all that stuff, is contact me or email me directly when the email address is Dietz, D-I-E-T-S, at C-S-W-S-T-2, like the number 2.com. So they could just email me and I'll send them a book.
That's wonderful. That is also amazing to hear that, you know, you're willing to interact with people. I find people all the time saying, you know, it's amazing that you'll talk to me. I didn't expect the response from you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I have no problem. I've talked to an unbelievable number of people on the radio, television, and just individuals who call up. In fact, a guy called me yesterday. He's got his own book that he's written about his wife, and he wants to talk about how he can get it published. You know, that stuff like that. And it's kind of neat to be able to talk to people. And again, that's part of the whole, might call it healing, but it's also part of life.
It is. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend it. I have read Dietz's book. It is an absolutely wonderful read. I highly recommend you rush out and get it. If you are looking for the contact information, you can always email me or go to my website, which is www.mystcspirit.com. If you've missed any of that and you would like for us to give the information to you again on how to contact Dietz, you can always email me at my address, and I would be happy to pass the information along. Now, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Shrove, for joining me on the show. It's been quite an enlightening experience speaking with you and reading your book.
And I'd like to
thank everyone for listening, and I hope everybody finds a reason to smile today.